Our guest this hour wants to reach out to those who may feel alienated from the world of poetry or the world of art, and yet have deeply felt experiences to record and honor. And that, I guess, includes almost everybody, doesn't it? Our guest is the current poet laureate for the state of Wisconsin, Max Garland, University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, professor of English, widely published award-winning poet, essayist, and fiction writer. He will be promoting poetry and creativity among all ages and also act as an advocate for imaginative engagement in poetry and the other arts in the state of Wisconsin. He has written two wonderful books of poetry, and they have each received a number of awards, The Postal Confessions and also Hunger Wide as Heaven, and his background is just very interesting. He's a first-generation college student. He left a 10-year career as a mail carrier in Kentucky, and of course there are some poems about that in one of his books, to pursue his love of poetry. Max earned a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing from the University of Iowa in 1989 and has been teaching since 1990, currently as a professor of English at UW-Eau Claire. We'll be welcoming phone calls, we'll be hearing some of his poetry, and because it is an hour of poetry, we'll also be listening to other poets during the course of this hour, and we welcome you to I know that there are many of you who feel deeply about a number of different issues and that you have recorded your own poems. Please don't make them way too long, but we'd love to hear from you as well. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and we've already had some messages left on our Facebook page, and we'll play some recordings of some of the poems that you have recommended on that page, and that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Max Garland, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it's a great pleasure. I love your poetry. I read the books last night and just had the best time. It's good. And what a life you've had.
Well, thank you. And thanks for getting me out in one of the coldest mornings of the year in Eau Claire. Yeah, I feel wide awake now.
Well, you can write a poem about how wide awake you are and how cold it is.
I was just rethinking my decision 23 years ago to move to Wisconsin this morning. So.
Yeah, I'm sure. We all rethink that every now and then. But I am interested in this idea that you have of reaching out to those who may have felt alienated from the world of poetry, and yet they have all these experiences to record and to honor. It's one of the reasons I think we read poetry, is to share those deeply felt experiences. But there are many poets among us, and they just don't write poetry.
I think that's true. And in your intro, you added something to my statement, which was, I think that includes just about everyone, doesn't it? And I think that is true. I think that when we communicate to one another, when we communicate publicly, we say valuable things, interesting things, but often a lot gets unsaid. A lot is not of our deepest emotions, of elements of who we are. For one thing, it's hard to say, and it's risky to say. And art in general, but specifically poetry, because it deals with language, is one of those ways that people have communicated those things that we all feel but rarely are able to share.
So I'm thinking about you delivering mail in western rural Kentucky, which is where I believe you delivered mail, composing poetry and thinking poetry as you were delivering mail. Were you doing that?
Yes. I wrote poetry even before I began that job, and I wrote during that. Some of the poems in my first book were written during that time. I'm not sure it helped my mail delivery efficiency very much, but it was a rural mail carrier. You have a lot of time on your own, and your mind is somewhat occupied, and there's a certain amount of solitude, and I guess my rural mail patrons survived, got most of their mail.
Well, that's good. And you also became a very keen observer of the natural world. A lot of your poetry is about light and bushes and trees and flowers and the ocean and the world that is all around us.
Yes, that's true. I recently was I took a group of freshman students in a writing course, and we walked through Owen Park in Eau Claire, and I was just, this wasn't my purpose, but I was pointing out, this is a white pine tree. This is why there's a town here, because of the white pine forest. This is an ash tree. This is a Norway maple. And I was saying these things, and this young woman said, how do you know these things? And I said, I live here. And I mean, it seemed to me one of the things that you would want to know. And that's of interest to me. It bothers me when I don't know the name of something that's growing and living around me.
Mm-hmm. What else do we need to know when we say, I live here? What else needs to nourish our souls and do we need to know in order to feel at home?
Well, I think there are factors that are important to the health and development of a culture. Some of them are economic, some of them are environmental, but some of them are interior. We live in a world in which your inner life sometimes is sacrificed to the demands of our outer life.
Mm-hmm.
We also live in a culture, not just in this state, in other states, where we are fairly inundated with language. We walk around with earbuds. We have screens in front of us, and those screens are often divided. There's a scroll across the bottom delivering a message to us. We have in our hands text messages. And so probably never before in human history has so much language come at us from so many different directions so constantly. And yet the depth of that language, the quiet, the solitude, the time that we have to reflect upon our own experience in our own language sometimes is threatened, I think, by the sheer number of words that are splashed over us on a daily basis.
How often do you take time for that reflection and the result is a poem? Are you a prolific poet?
I write a lot of poems. I write a lot more poems than I ever show to anyone. I usually start every morning, almost every morning, writing something.
Really?
It could just be something I remembered from the day before. Mm. It could be the draft of a poem. It could be the weather. It just something. You know, I do feel if you play the violin, you need to play a little each day. If you're going to be a dancer, if you're going to be an athlete, and if you're going to be a writer, whether anyone sees it or not, whether it comes to anything beyond you or not, it's important to keep that habit alive.
And when does it go beyond you? How do you know it should go beyond you?
Sometimes you get lucky. Sometimes the words what you write, you recognize is a little smarter than you are. And that's an interesting phenomenon. You know, people sometimes think, well, if you're a writer, you have these thoughts in your head, and what you do is translate them, these pieces of wisdom onto the page. But for a lot of writers, and certainly I feel this way, it's not like that. It's like a conversation. You don't know exactly what you're going to say because you don't know what the other person is going to say. And as you begin to think about things that are a part of your life that you remember, that bug you or excite you, sometimes ideas begin to sort of unfurl out of that. And you find yourself with a thought that you never could have started with.
Hmm. And how long have you been writing those thoughts every day? Did you start as a child?
Not so much as a child. I think I was interested in words even as a child. I didn't come from a background where it was possible to know there was such a thing as a living poet. I think I thought poets were these sort of like Greek philosophers. They had once existed, and maybe if we studied them, it was sort of to show that we were educated people. But I actually didn't know you could be one. I didn't know there were people still doing it. It was really in college, a little bit, excuse me,
sure,
a little bit under the influence of the singer-songwriters of the late 60s and early 70s, and a little bit under the influence of the English Romantic poets that I discovered in a big, thick anthology, which I still have, that made me feel the impulse to write. And so I began to write very bad poems.
And who were those singer-songwriters you were listening to?
I think it was sort of fortunate at that time. pop music and popular music was undergoing a big change. People like Joni Mitchell, Bob Dylan, Leonard Cohen, Judy Collins, Neil Young, people like that, you could hardly help but notice we're putting more complex and interesting and imaginative lyrics mm-hmm. in songs that were nevertheless popular. And that was, I knew something was happening in those songs that you know, I could almost understand, but even when I couldn't understand it, they evoked a feeling in me and a curiosity and a sense of mystery. And I thought, I didn't know, I don't even know if I would have said it at the time, but what I was reacting to was poetry in a popular medium. Mm.
Have you written lyrics for songs?
Yes, I do. I do write songs, and I play in a band.
Oh, you do?
That I take half seriously sometimes. But I write, and I also put some more classical poems to music at times.
Oh, very nice. I didn't know that. Do you have that recorded somewhere?
I do. So here's a plug for Eggplant Heroes, which is the band, and we have one CD out, and if we ever can all get together again, we may put another one out. But
who knows, one of these days you may become stars, right?
Yeah, maybe, if I live long enough. I've lived quite a long time safely avoiding becoming a star, and I think I probably will continue to do so.
We're going to ask you to read some. You have your books with you, I hope, don't you?
Yes, I do.
I'm going to ask you to read one of my favorites that you wrote, and we're also going to open this to the audience. We're talking about poetry this hour. We'll play some other poets as well. Robert Frost, who died 50 years ago this week, actually. We will play some Edna Svensson Millay and the poet who performed at the inaugural for President Obama. We will play Mango Number 61. And welcome your phone calls, too. Let's talk about poetry. I know that some of you are poets. The last time we talked about poetry, we were flooded with phone calls with some really good poems. What about this idea of poetry not being a part of our everyday lives, that we're alienated from the world of poetry, and yet we're all poets. We have experiences that we feel very deeply. We think about them. Sometimes we go to poets to put what we're feeling into some kind of context, shared context. Here's our phone number for you to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can also share your poems on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Before we pause for a moment, and we're speaking with the new poet laureate for the state of Wisconsin, one of the images that has stayed with me ever since I saw it, and I'm glad you wrote a poem about it, is the Sistine Chapel. And I love your poem with the image of the empty space that Michelangelo left between the hands of Adam and God that's on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. We've seen that image reproduced in so many places. And I loved that poem. Could you read it?
Yes, I don't usually read this poem. It's a little longer, but I visited the Sistine Chapel twice. The first time, they had not yet cleaned it, and so it was very dark and somber. The second time, it took 4 years, but they had just cleaned that portion right at the center of the Sistine Chapel, that little space between God's hand and Adam's hand. And it was the first time in hundreds of years anyone had seen brightly that space, and they hadn't cleaned the rest of it yet, so it was very interesting. Michelangelo painted this backwards. He started with the latter-day occurrences, the fall and the flood and all, and painted backwards, and the last thing he painted was the creation, and that's the way they cleaned it, and all of these things. So I actually wrote the draft of this poem sitting in the Sistine Chapel. It's called Revisiting the Sistine Chapel. They've just cleaned the creation of man, God's beard newly whitened, blown back in a turbulent cloud as he reaches for the left hand of Adam, his first mistake. Adam's left arm, il sinistro, lazily balanced on his knee, the outline of the serpent already lounging in the musculature. The next two panels are shrouded for the cleaning of the stars and plants. Across the curtain covering the scaffold, the restorer's shadows slowly move like moths tiring in a lampshade. They're working backwards through time the way Michelangelo painted the world. First the flood, then the fall, then Eve lured from the dreaming Adam, her hands posed in an attitude of prayer, or like a child's hands poised for a first dive, then the creation of Adam himself. And only then, exhausted, embittered by perfect knowledge of where it all would lead, did he paint the birth of light, a fresco barely visible, still uncleaned, God's robes whirling toward definition, arms raised, face upturned away from the viewer. Though you can see, God was older in the beginning, his beard thin and feathery, his shoulders stiff. The chaos from which he lifts himself seems almost too much for him. Foreknowledge weakens. You can see it from here. An older hand stirs the light than the hand that nearly touches Adam in the fresco they've just cleaned, making it easier to follow Adam's gaze, originally assumed to rest on God, but clearly now sweeping past him to the newly restored figure of Eve nestled in the crook of the floating God's arm, her body caught in the last moment of girlhood, changing as she turns, changed by the turning, her hair bundled much brighter than anyone imagined. Looking up at the creation of man, now that the dust, soot, gum, and resin have been rubbed away, the patchings and dubious repaintings, it seems clear, after all the storms and labor, who will remain as lonely as ever, the passion of his creatures already straying from him. And though it will be decades before Michelangelo paints the judgment, it seems clear what stokes the fire. Not anger or justice or even jealousy, but loneliness, God's dilemma. The reason he fled the void in the first place, although the ailment swept in with him in the folds of his robe or the billows of his hair, the thing he must have known the light would not alter, even as he reached for it, as if a single straw could break the back of all that dark. Which is what makes that famous gap, those newly brightened inches between the finger of God and the lounging hand of man, the reason for the painting, or the vault of the chapel itself, or the upturned face of the visitor, straining to see, wanting to stay, yet jostled and swept along by waves of perfect strangers, as God knew they would become, even as he reached for Adam and felt himself stilled, frozen in mid-flight, where Michelangelo would later find him, as if already painted, precious inches away.
Revisiting the Sistine Chapel, I love that poem, read and written by our current poet laureate for the state of Wisconsin, Max Garland. Our guest this hour is the new Wisconsin Poet Laureate, UW Eau Claire Professor Max Garland. We're welcoming phone calls. We're talking about making poetry accessible to everyone this hour of the show. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. You can email at talk@wpr.org with your favorite short poem, or perhaps you have a poem that is 140 characters or less, and you can tweet us your literary art. Oh, I like that. That's at Kay Dunn Show. Let's go to phone calls for you, Max, and we'll start with Tristan in Appleton. Hi, Tristan.
Hi.
Hi.
So, I guess basically, first let me thank my dear friend Barb Spellman, who was my middle school teacher, who introduced me to poetry.
Great.
But I guess one of the things I've been writing, like I said, since middle school, and all these years I've written and written and written and kept on writing, and I think it's hard for somebody, like you said, when you don't know whether your poetry, first of all, is of quality and worth actually being published, you know, how do you find either mentors or, I mean, do you just jump off the ledge and just start sending your poetry out to people? Or, I mean, I guess, you know, I've always wanted to find out whether my poetry was good enough to be published. So I guess would like to know, I guess, what's the best way to go about trying to find that out?
Okay. Max?
That's a very interesting and useful question. And I think everybody, ask that question, everyone who writes or everyone who writes for very long. You actually continue to ask that question after you've been published a lot when you write each new poem. Unfortunately, you still think, is this worth publishing? First of all, the poem is worth writing, whether it's worth publishing or not, in my opinion. Mm. As I said before, most of what I write, I don't even want it to see the light of day. But it's important because if I do happen to write something that I think will communicate something to someone else, I probably wouldn't have written it unless I'd written all of that other stuff that never sees the light of day. I mean, you just have to keep flexing, you know, the muscles, you know, from which our language and our intelligence is spawned. And so I think that writing for yourself is no small thing, first of all. Then I think you, at some point, it's a natural thing to want to get the reaction of a reader. It's not always easy to find a good reader, a reader who won't just because that reader loves you say, that's great. That's good. But there are often in places such as where you live and in most communities, even some rather small communities, there usually are writers groups. And I began to go to those when I was a mailman, and I began to gradually get a little more confidence, you know, when I would read my poems. First of all, when I began to read my poems to other people, I read them so rapidly because I was so terrified that, you know, no one could even understand them. But then when I realized, oh, wait, I have to slow down. These words are just zooming through the air. And so that was helpful. Then reading a lot of poetry, that's being written now. A lot more is available online. I'm a big lover of books and libraries, but you can, you can find dozens of the poems of Richard Blanco, who just read the inaugural poem, of the current poet laureate Natasha Trethewey. And you can, you know, poetry, it's about what's coming from inside you, but it's also a conversation. And most people who develop as poets find some kinship with another poet out there, a published poet, and you begin to pick up things, and you begin to just as a musician would want to listen to other musicians. So I guess I'll now condense my answer: reading a lot, seeing what's being written, and continuing to write, and maybe finding a small local community of people who you can trust and who will give you some encouragement and yet some honest feedback.
Max, we have a request, an email from a postal worker who called and said she would like for you to read a poem, and I know that you've written at least one aria for the U.S. Mail. Maybe there are others. For all of the postal workers who are driving around delivering mail right now.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. Well, okay, I'm going to read The Postal Confessions.
Okay.
It's right before that. And this is not exactly in praise of the postal service necessarily, although I actually liked that job very much. My grandfather was a mailman. I was the mail carrier on the route where I was born and where I lived and where my parents lived. And so it was quite a part of my – it was like remembering my life every single day.
Mm-hmm.
But this is really – it's about working at the post office, but it's also about feeling like you might possibly be living the wrong life. And I think a lot of people who work think this at times. The Postal Confessions. The sorting machine whirs like the blades of a fan. You could fall asleep if it weren't for the money, if it weren't for the fact that the work is already much deeper than sleep. And what could you fall into lower than life you never intended, yet inhabit, like the rumble in the conveyor's constant moan? The strange thing is, hardly anyone writes anymore, yet the tonnage builds and builds. Hardly anyone spills even a grain of his life in a letter, yet the machines whir and jam, the bundles threaten to topple, the mail cases bulge with billing and the inky brightness of sales pitch. You could fall asleep if it weren't for the third cup of vending machine coffee, which resembles in color, texture, and taste the silted waters of the Ohio in spring, which is why they built the town in the first place, to drink the waters of the river, to burden the long twisted back of the river with barges and bridges, to sit in the slump of afternoon watching the sun float down from white to yellow to red to maroon, the last few gulls raking the far shore, as if even the shadows were richer there.
Oh, I like that one. I really like that one. You take in so much. That's a thing about poetry, isn't it? That it your mind is in many places at the same time. You're in the natural world. You're in the physical world. You're in the world of the job. You're taking it all in a very deep way.
Yeah, I think that is true. I mean, my own personal taste in poetry run to people like Mary Oliver, William Stafford, Philip Levine. I like Natasha Trethewey, the current poet laureate's poetry a lot, too. Robert Frost, I think sometimes is underappreciated these days. But I like poems that have a surface appeal, like you can tell the poem. This is about somebody who was working as a mailman. But if you read the poem again, if you read one of Frost's great poems again, you know it's about more than walking through the woods. You know it's about more than, going out to break the ice out of the water trough. You believe that,
right.
But that is only part. And that's why, as Ezra Pound said about literature, he said, literature is news that stays news. And you can read, Robert Frost died 50 years ago this week, but you can read a poem of his that was written 70, 90 years ago. It's still news. And the news that was playing right before this program is not going to be news 90 years from now.
Right. Let's hear Robert Frost. Now that you brought him up, I'm hungry to hear him. This is probably his most famous poem, and we should honor him because he did die 50 years ago this week.
Stopping by woods on a snowy evening. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sound's the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep.
Let's go to Joseph, our next caller in Almond, Wisconsin. Hello, Joseph.
Hello, Kathleen, and hello, Max. I am so pleased to be able to speak with you today. I wanted to make two comments and then share just four lines. The first comment was about Max's comment about poets living in rarefied atmosphere and being just old and often dead. And I just want to underscore how poetry is such a living thing. And I also want to congratulate Max in his poetry for writing poetry that is accessible, because it's in the heart understanding of a poem that people can really live and be expanded. And so I'm going to share this last verse of a poem that's called "It's a Job in a Tough Economy." The poet lives with sacred madness, dancing free and wild and cladless, anointing human loss and sadness, magnifying love and gladness. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Joseph, for your call.
Wonderful, wonderful contribution.
Isn't it? I love doing this show. It's just, you're making the point that this is why we do poetry. It's the reason for
A lot of people, when I was in graduate school, I was a little older than most of the other graduates, and there was this a discussion about risk, taking a risk as a poet. And, I thought I took a pretty big risk quitting a job I'd had for life and leaving the place. I was crazy, basically. But the risk in poetry was often thought of as writing challenging or dark or obscure or abstract poetry, and you were risking that people would not understand you. But risk is also writing with clarity and taking the risk that people will underestimate you or think that your poetry is simple or right. simple-minded mm-hmm. Because it has a surface meaning to it, without understanding that often that surface meaning is just one level of it. And so I think that it takes a lot of nerve to try to speak rather clearly also.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Gay in Madison. Hi, Gay.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to say that I do live with poetry every day, and it's my way of keeping a journal instead of the boring task of I did this and I did that and the weather was such and such today. So I sit down and I write a poem, whether it's any good or not. Doesn't matter to me. Are you there?
Oh, we're here. We're listening.
Okay. And I wrote one just now for Robert Frost. It's not very long. May I read it?
Please do.
Okay. Robert, well, I got a page up here. I am writing it right now. Robert Frost died 50 years ago today. Not Jack Frost, as my students like to say. Though both were artists of the silver kind of day. Robert Frost passed like the hired man, his miles to go deplete, his birches swung, his walls all mended, his brooks all streamed, and his apples gathered. He went down to the pasture spring one last time, and the little calf that tottered has likely now gone down to slaughter. He found nothing gold or silver yet could stay, and when the roads diverged in the yellow wood, he took the only one left there was to take. Robert Frost has gone, and will it be fire or ice?
Ooh, I like that, Gay. Max?
He referenced about 8 poems of Frost in that
yes.
one poem. Frost is, he may be the last poet, he died 50 years ago this week, he may be the last American poet whom everyone knew, whether you were interested in literature or not. And it's interesting, he read at Kennedy's inauguration, and I remember that reading. He couldn't, the wind was blowing, the
right.
light was on the page, and he actually recited a poem, not the one that he wrote for the occasion. But previous to that election, he was more famous than Kennedy. He used to talk about Kennedy in his readings, promoting him himself. And it's rather interesting that perhaps Allen Ginsberg was known by a lot of people, but I don't think anyone has had that stature. And when I first read Frost, I thought he was a kindly old grandfather writing nice rhyming poems about snow and harness bell shaking. But as I read him and as I read him now, that was a small part. There was that, but there were also darknesses and mystery in his poetry that keep on revealing themselves as you get older in your own life.
How important, or are we overstating the importance here, that President Obama had Richard Blanco reading, and Blanco is an interesting person as well as cultural background and what he writes about, reading Mango number 61 at the inauguration. Is it important for us to have somebody given that kind of prominence by the president?
Yes, I think it is. And I mean, this goes back at many public occasions throughout history, but in my memory, at least since 1960, I think that it is one of those occasions. And what I said about earlier about a lot of people feeling alienated from poetry and feeling like it's this distant, obscure, and perhaps not quite so relevant thing, I think we forget that in public occasions throughout time and history, the poet has usually been a part of the expression of particularly important moments, from the early bards who memorized thousands of lines of poetry that spoke to the history of their tribe, that remembered the old legends. Remember, poetry is far, far, far older than written speech, than alphabets that were recorded and codified. And mm-hmm. and the poet's brain was the library of various cultures. And I think when you have, if you've been to a christening, a wedding, a memorial service, a church service, if you've heard a snatch of a song you can't get out of your head, if you've just been in a conversation and suddenly someone has said something that has put an idea in a particularly striking and compact way, that's poetry too. And I think our public occasions, given the amount of sales pitch and political manipulation and sound bites and talking points, someone speaking from the heart, someone, mm-hmm. That is a very valuable thing.
I agree. Let's go to Rolf in Egg Harbor next. Hi, Rolf.
Hi.
Hi.
I want to congratulate Max on his recent appointment. And I want to comment on the fact that I live in Door County, and there are a number of really wonderful poetry groups up here, and we have a monthly get-together where we have a featured poet, and then we follow with an open mic reading, and that's once a month up in Ephraim at the UU Fellowship Hall.
Nice.
And it has really helped me become a more confident and a more engaged poet. And so I would like to read a poem.
Sure.
It is a comic poem.
Okay.
But it also has a note of seriousness. It's about the life of a poet. Line violation. I was pulled over yesterday by a well-versed muse. "What were you doing in the express line?" she asked. "Actually, I was musing," I replied. "Ha," she barked, "very funny." "Okay," I was searching for a word. "You know you can't do that there. You block the flow of real poets. Words get backed up all over the place. Take out your wallet." I showed her my poetic license. "Ha," she says, "attempts." She asked if I had any checkbooks in the car. "Less than a dozen," I replied. "Well, show me your ISBN registration." And her hand went for her pen as she stepped back slightly. "I know it's here," I said. "It's not something I use every day." "Right, no real poet would say that." "I know," I said. "All right," she said, "here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to write you a warning. I want this on the record. It's going to cost you a checkbook. And I don't want to see you in the express line again." She handed me the warning, stuck the pen behind her ear, turned and walked away. I looked in the mirror. God, she had stanzas.
Thank
I didn't
you,
expect
Rolf.
That, didn't
I? I didn't either. Thank you, Rolf, so much. We're going to continue our conversation listening to some of your poetry and speaking with Max Garland, who for 2013 and 2014 is the Poet Laureate for the state of Wisconsin. He's written some marvelous poems. He's a professor of English at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, and joining us from our studios in Eau Claire this hour on a cold, cold day in the state. We thank him for being with us. I'm interested in how he became Poet Laureate, and we want to know a little bit more about what kind of outreach he plans to do. So we'll find out, and we'll talk to you some more as well. 800-486-8655. You can email talk at WPR.org with your favorite short poem or question for Max. Or if you have a poem that's 140 characters or less, you can tweet us with your literary art at KDUN Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Scars. They tell how it was, and how time came along, and how it happened again and again. They tell the slant life takes when it turns and slices your face as a friend. Any wound is real. In church, a woman lets the sun find her cheek, and we see the lesson. There are years in that book. There are sorrows a choir can't reach when they sing. Rows of children lift their faces of promise, places where the scars will be.
One of your mentors, William Stafford, scars. Why do you like him? Why is he a mentor?
I didn't know that clip was going to play. It's very moving. He was a friend and mentor of mine. Mm. When I was studying poetry as a student, as an undergraduate, I began to like it a lot, but the language was antique language. I loved it. And so I tried to imitate what poetry I knew. Shakespeare, Keats, Shelley, Wordsworth, even Dylan Thomas a little bit later, but still it wasn't my language. William Stafford is one of the first living and contemporary poets where I heard a language that sounded more like conversation, but yet was elevated and compressed just enough beyond conversation so that it contained more meaning and more emotion. And I realized you didn't have to dress up in 16th or 17th or 18th century linguistic garb to be a poet. You could be a poet from your own voice. And Stafford always said, when people ask him, like, who is your influence? Who's the voice that influences your poetry? He said it was his mother.
Oh.
And in some ways, I think my grandmother, my grandfather, people like that, those are the voices I hear. And I love abstract and experimental poetry and all of that. And I think strange things creep into my poetry. But I always remember them. My first dose of poetry were probably the hymns that my grandmother sang. And Stafford was somebody who also had a feeling that everybody was a writer. Everyone had thoughts that they wanted to express and couldn't quite, and those thoughts were worth something, whether the rest of the world ever wanted to hear them or not. And if you were a poet and you made a habit of that, occasionally those thoughts would be of interest to other people. And that it was more like a natural progression in which one became a poet, as opposed to, you know, this great streak of lightning coming down and striking
right.
someone with genius. It was more a normal human activity.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Mark in Shorewood next. Hi, Mark.
Hey, good morning, gentle people. I have a brief but potentially appropriate poem. And first of all, Max, have you read Charles Bukowski's Post Office?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I did. I used
that.
To really look at writers who were postmen first, and he was one of them.
Excellent. And now I'll give you this brief reading here. The roar of the winter wind predisposes us to obvious persuasions, the interior warmth to be held on to tighter. And you guys have a great day.
Thank you so much,
Thank
Mark.
You,
you
Thank
too.
You.
Ken is next in Hingham. Hi, Ken. Ken, are you there? Oh, Ken's not there. Call us back if you want to reach us. Tell me about this being poet laureate of the state of Wisconsin. That's quite a title, isn't it, Max?
Yes, it is. I'm having to explain what the word laureate means a lot. And, yeah, it is pretty strange. I'm just now getting used to it. I'm not there's a part of me, honestly, that sort of likes solitude and likes to be sort of left to my own devices. I mean, I have a teaching job, and I appear in front of people talking about poetry often. But there's a part of me that sort of feels like withdrawing and writing. And, you know, I think writers ought to spend a lot of time sitting at their desk or wherever they write and writing. However, I was asked, you know, if I could be nominated, and, you know, if so, if I were selected, would I do it? And I said yes. And I do think that if you get a lot in your life, if you had doors open to you in a certain art form, you owe it a little bit of payback. You owe a little something to the art form. And there could be someone else out there, like me, many years ago, who doesn't know that poetry is an ongoing human endeavor, that doesn't know that that poetry can come, or art can come from a place like they grew up in, from a place like the outskirts of Paducah, Kentucky, or New Auburn, Wisconsin, or places like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, okay, I should do this. And like the person who talked about thanking his, I think, high school or grade school or
yes.
junior high school teacher.
Yes.
Resources for art get squeezed in tough economic
times. They sure
do. And frankly, one of the reasons I did this is I was hurt, shamed, and angered by the reduction in the support for art by our state.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually embarrassing to me as a proud citizen of Wisconsin. And I thought that maybe I should enter into the conversation and remind people of the importance of art. And, you know, no one would have known in 1867 that a little boy growing up and being born in Richmond Center would become one of the great architects in human history, whose work would be a tourist attraction in Madison now. But that became Frank Lloyd Wright. No one knew that a little girl in Sun Prairie would become one of the great American artists when she was in school. I'm glad there was someone there to encourage her talent. That became Georgia O'Keeffe.
Yes.
No one knew that in 1933, a man moving to Madison would become one of the originators of the of our new appreciation of wilderness and wildlife management, but that was Aldo Leopold. And this list goes on and on. And there's somebody now on the outskirts of Rhinelander. There's a little girl, there's a little boy who has that talent, whose artwork or music or poetry may be read 400 years from now. And I want our state and our culture to value that possibility and support it.
Oh, that's a great answer. I think we have Ken with us now in Hingham. Hi, Ken.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, Ken.
Yeah, I'm calling first. I guess I thank you, the guests, for coming on, and I am a rural mail carrier myself.
Oh,
great.
Enjoying your program. And I guess I want to start by saying I miss Gene Faraca. And a couple of comments I had was talking about the muse and writing each day and writing when you can't find the muse. And the gentleman's poem about the muse just recently made me think of the author of Eat, Pray, Love, I think, was on. And she was talking about grabbing that muse and struggling and wrestling and trying to find the words when they weren't coming. And I was just, at the time, I had taken my dad to the honor flights to Washington, D.C.
Oh,
and
you did.
And
uh-huh.
My church had asked me just to say a few things about it, and I was just struggling with words to say and kind of started wrestling with the muse at that time and went kind of with a little presentation that I really wasn't satisfied with. But when I started talking, it was like I started listening to what I was saying, and words were coming out that I hadn't prepared and were much better than what I had written down. It was kind of a interesting experience. And then lastly, I guess I'm married for 42 years and love my wife. And one morning I woke up early in the middle of the night and was just laying next to her. And I kind of composed this short little poem. It's like this. I am her. She is me. We are us. And that's all I had.
Thank you. Thanks so much for your call.
And thank you very much.
Yeah.
That's
we are almost.
And I just wanted to say one other thing.
Sure.
Sometimes, even if a poem is only for you, I mean, we need the expressions of things that are very hard and sometimes very difficult to express. And sometimes there is a redeeming quality to those expressions, and it helps us.
If people are interested, I don't want to get you overbooked because I know that being poet laureate doesn't cover, I mean, you don't make enough money to cover your expenses for this. But if people are interested in having you be with them, how do they do that?
I'm available. I can be emailed through my email at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. The Wisconsin Academy of Science, Arts, and Letters in Madison is also providing generously a home for the current poet laureate. And so contacting through that route also is possible.
Wonderful. Well, Max, thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations on the appointment. From all I can gather, it's well-deserved. And thanks for your poetry and for this discussion.
I appreciate it. Glad to be here, and I appreciated the offerings of the callers as well.
Yes, so did we. Max Garland, the poet laureate of the state of Wisconsin, just started his term 2013-2014. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for putting a whole lot of work into this program. I had a great time, did you? Conversations Ahead will be with you again on Monday.